So the format and the ones that are on the site, because it's sort of meant to be StoryCorps is like a collective memory, like people, just regular people talking to regular people. And so sometimes it can be done by members, and that's kind of what we're hoping to do by building up the library. But then sometimes you'll have something a little bit more formal. And so we're going to – this is going to be somewhere between informal and formal. I know that Anne and Felicita already sent you sort of a list of sort of prompter things.
Yeah.
Just to mull over, but nothing.
Yeah.
Okay. We always like to think of it just as like a nice casual conversation between us and the world afterwards.
Yeah. All right. So so the way that I like to start these whenever I'm doing them is say my name. My name is Nathaniel Janik, and today is the 26th of July, 2018, and we're here at the temporary AGU headquarters. I'm with Tong Zhu and Felicita White. Tong is here because it's a governance board meeting. Is that right? Oh, Governance Committee. Yes, yeah. And so we're doing this interview today to put up on the StoryCorps app for the AGU Narratives Project, which is part of Centennial. Just to tell you a little bit about myself here at AGU, I am the Career Services Coordinator. So one of the things that I work on is we have a project called Path Through Science, where we sort of highlight the careers of people and the stories of how they got to where they're at. So sometimes with these interviews, depending on the flavor of the interview, I'll sometimes take the interview and turn it into a little short little article piece to highlight some of the career stuff. So that's one of the reasons why I help with this project too, is because we're Centennial and the Career Center scratching each other's backs. Right. Yeah, right.
True collaborative collaboration.
Yeah. So I know from like, you know, looking and on the website and talking to Liz a little bit about your background, but I was hoping you can tell me like outside of AGU what it is that you do as a scientist.
So where did it stop?
Yeah, we're starting, yeah.
Okay, my name is Tong Zhu. I am an atmospheric chemist. So I've been studying on the air pollution and its impact on human health for many years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I know you've been involved with a lot of different projects. Mm-hmm. Are you part of a like a university there, or do you work for the government?
Yes, at the moment I have been a university professor for about 19 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I started for my bachelor and a master degree at Peking University. Then I went to Germany, got my doctorate degree, and I went to Canada, and then back to China to Peking University in 1999, and I have been professor there for since then.
Mm-hmm. And I know I saw one of the big things that you've worked on is the 2008 Olympics and working on the air quality there during all of that. Can you tell us a little bit about what that experience was like?
Well, yes, it's a very unique experience because we scientists do the research and we find the results and we publish the results. And this time when we do the research, not only to find the results, but also find the provide the solution. And this solution is very important for the government to implement as a policy. And it's also like a life experiment of we've done, and the government is following our advice to take action. And this action has to be proved that our solution suggestions right. So this is a very challenging, but it's very fruitful for us to have this kind of experience.
Yeah, so that particular example is such a wonderful example of something that AGU really wants to do of, you know, showing how the science and society come together. What was the experience like for you? Because I imagine, you know, as a scientist, as an atmospheric chemistry, right?
Right.
That oftentimes it's, you know, just working in the lab, going out to the field to do your experiments, but not always interacting with the public or doing something that is so public facing. Like I can remember watching the 2008 Olympics and hearing the discussions about the air quality, and it hadn't dawned on me at the time until I was reading it that, you know, that there was a team of scientists that was working to address that problem. So what was that experience like for you to have such a public facing project that you were working on?
Well, it's a very good story.
Yeah.
Before the Beijing Olympics, I've been working on, as you said, in the lab and outfield and doing something following our curiosity. But I remember in 2005, one of my friends, she was an officer of the Environment Protection Bureau in Beijing, asked me to write a proposal. At that time, Beijing government are very serious about air pollution control, so they want to know how to find a solution and to reduce the air pollution levels during the Beijing Olympics. So they wanted the scientists to have this research to be conducted to have a policy relevant one. The one we are taking is more complicated because before we think air pollution in the city, it's responsibility of the city to take control. But Beijing is a very unique case, because it's surrounded by other provinces which have a much larger emission of pollutants than Beijing itself. So that means if Beijing take actions, it won't solve the problem, and then they have to take care of the whole this intra-province actions. So we need to understand how high the emission of air pollutants emit at a different province, what industrial sectors are responsible for that, and how the meteorology influence transport of air pollutant from different air mass come to Beijing. And throughout the way the air mass transport, how intensive the chemical reactions convert the primary pollutants into the secondary one.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a scientific question to be addressed, be started, and these questions can be converted to the policy relevant suggestions.
Mm-hmm. Let me make sure this is actually flipped there.
Okay.
Okay, yeah, all right.
It's actually recording.
Yeah. No, it's recording. I'm like, where are the levels here? Okay.
Yeah.
So.
That makes me think of the PM
2.5. Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about what that is and the significance of what that will mean?
Yeah, PM 2.5 is a term people use for almost 20 years now, because they are responsible for the health impact of air pollutants, most significant one. It's a term referred to the particle with size smaller than 2.5 micrometers. And so it's in the air everywhere you can breath in. And the levels of PM2.5 could be very high, so it could be very harmful to human health. So as scientists, atom chemists, we want to understand where does the PM2.5 come from. So it came from a direct emission of the cars, stoves, and industry, and it can also came from a chemical reaction, sometimes called that from biogenic emission of volatile organic compounds. That's like terpenes from the trees. It can also have photochemical reaction leading to the PM2.5 or particles. So this is a very complicated source, and to control that, it requires a lot of knowledge of how it's formed, how it's transported, and where that came from. So it's not a single source, but a multi-source from different sectors in industry, domestic, transport, etc.
And during this meeting, you guys come together and try to, I don't want to say solve the issue, but come up with a solution. We've seen reports and the Montreal Protocol and the Charney Report are good examples. Do you Are you hoping that something like that will come out of these meetings?
Which meeting?
You guys will do the conference,
mm-hmm.
and what would you hope the goal would be to come out of that?
I want to try to clarify. For the Beijing Olympics, for example, for us, it's a very important target to reduce the PM2.5 levels to the acceptable levels that athletes can come here to Beijing to participate in games. So there's WHO has its guidelines, and the Chinese has recently set up a national ambient air quality for the levels of PM2.5. For us, before the Beijing Olympic, we have this project funded by the Beijing municipal government. And at that time, we are quite open because we think because the complicated situation, understand this pollution, how it's formed. So we organized an international campaign. So we invited scientists from US, Germany, and Japan, Korea to join us. We have about more than 20 research institutes around the world. And almost 200 scientists and students participated in this campaign, try to understand how the chemical reactions going on, how the air pollutants are transported in the air, and then we based on this one to come up to the suggestion for the policy to control the air pollutions. So as you mentioned about this, atoms chemistry is trying to understand how the compositions in the air or in the atmosphere changed and how it impacts on our whole climate and also the air quality and the human health. So this is a very important and a very challenging research fields. And Montreal Protocol is one of the most successful international convention for the protection of human and the whole Earth system from the ozone layer depletion, which is a very good example for that. Yeah.
So because this is going to be used for the centennial,
mm-hmm.
One of the things that we want to ask people about is, you know, just sort of reflecting on the past 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
The question that I've posed to people is, what would you say within the past 100 years is like the most important either discovery or advancement within your sciences? So within the atmospheric sciences, what would you say was like it doesn't necessarily have to be the number one, because that's kind of hard to really whittle it down. But what do you think is, you know, one of the most important advancements?
There are a number of them.
Yeah.
I would like to, for example, to understand how the photo smog, like the Los Angeles smog, formed, the chemical process going on there. And the scientists had found ozone was responsible for the smog in Los Angeles in 1950s, and how the chemical reaction leading to the ozone formation. And this is a very fundamental understanding. This is one of the most important advances in our field. And the second one is how are the ozone destroyed in the stratosphere by chemicals like freons, which was proposed by scientists in the 1970s and approved the ozone hole in 1980s. And the Montreal Protocol is based on that one, and ever since that the control of the freon and CFCs and has been very successful in controlling ozone hole to that extent. So these two, I think, are the most important advance in our fields of atmospheric chemistry.
What were the atmospheric sciences like prior to that? I mean, I'm not really sure about the history. Like, when I think about atmospheric sciences,
mm-hmm.
I mean, we were both born in the 80s. So, like, the idea of the ozone layer, we've just had it built in. But, I mean, what was the atmospheric sciences like back then?
Yeah, this is a very good question. Yeah, at first we need to know there's a layer of ozone in the stratosphere, and it kind of wonder how did the scientists find that. So back in the early time, they have this sun spectrometer to look at the absorption of UV light. They found that there's some parts of UV was absorbed by certain chemicals. They suggest it's from the ozone. So they'd be able to calculate how high the concentration of ozone in the stratosphere by looking at the sunlight and the different angles. So it's amazing that scientists can know the ozone is there from the, they don't have to go to there in the stratosphere, just on the surface, on the ground, then they measure that. And then in the 1970s, it's a number of theories have been proposed that human activities could have a significant impact of ozone layer. At the time, there's one scientist suggests that the supersonic aircraft emission of lot of nitrogen oxides, we call NOx. And there's also scientists suggest the nitrous oxide from the ground. And there's some scientists in that, they said maybe the freons. So it was very, very well unique time. You look at the history that the people have certain ideas. They try to put this different concept into a picture. And so by the 1980s, people have clear or relatively clear ideas that human-made chemicals could destroy the ozone layer, but still they don't have the evidence. So there was a satellite to map the ozone concentration globally. And with that satellite, they clearly observed ozone hole in Antarctic. Mm-hmm. And so there's come another question, because why in Antarctic? Antarctica. So there's a more serious, more laboratory study in the field measurement to provide certain kind of polar stratosphere clouds. They have this kind of chemical reactions within the clouds and cloud crystal happening there, and that is showing much more efficient in there. Ozone because of that one. So there's a polar vortex and the polar stratosphere cloud. So this is large scale meteorology and the chemical reactions joint networking on leading to the ozone hole in the over Antarctic. So this is a fascinating story for us. Yeah.
So moving away from the past, what I guess sort of scientific question or maybe societal question do you hope atmospheric sciences will answer in the next 100 years?
Wow, this is a very good question. Yeah, we know the composition chemical composition in the atmosphere are constantly changing, and how this changing chemical composition in the atmosphere impact on climate system and also human health. So this is the critical issues now we are trying to answer. And if we are able to reduce the greenhouse effect through this absorption of the all these radiations, and in the meantime, are able to make sure the human health impact from the air pollutants could be reduced to certain levels that could be acceptable for our whole human society. So this is, I think, is a very challenging question, and still we are working on that.
I think that we're close to out of time. We have time for one more question. I just wanted to make sure, because you had sort of, Anne had sent the list of questions. Was there a story that you wanted to bring to the table that we just haven't touched upon? Something that you want to share?
Well, there's a lot of stories I would like to share with you. One example is sometimes I think now I have been studied health effect of air pollution very intensively in the last almost 17 years. This is because at the time our university was merged with Beijing Medical University. So we think if the merging of these two universities, what we can do, and there's a topic people propose, like the environment health. So they want to know the changing environment, how would that impact on human health. So I was requested to lead this program. And I realized in the next couple of years that people from very different backgrounds, we can talk very different language. Even the same name may have a different meaning. And so to try to learn, understand the meaning of the other fields is very critical for the interdisciplinary research. So this is the one, I think, a very important lesson for me to learn. And the second one is people have to be brave enough to step out of the comfort room. And there's also a challenge because you may not have enough credit for your original, your trained field or disciplinary, because they may not be able to appreciate or credit, give you the credit for what you are doing. Then you have to be brave enough to facing that challenge too. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you have anything else that you'd like to ask Tong while he's here?
I had one follow-up. I'm glad you shared that other story. You have worked on at AGU. You're a leader here. You've not only are participating in the governance board, which helps to structure overall AGU and what we do. You've also are a steering committee member, and you know you're from China. You've done collaborative work around the world. I just wanted to ask you a little bit what the importance of doing collaborative and being international. What the value of that is in not only in science but also as a scientist.
Yeah, this is very good. Also very important question. Yes, many research we are working on is actually applied globally. So we do the regional or local study on air pollution, but actually you can see that many problems we share together. For example, for the air pollution, we can learn a lot from US since the 1950s, you have done this a lot of studies. So we benefit a lot from the lessons experience US scientists have done and also European scientists. So this is a very important one. And the second one is for us, like we have worked on Beijing Olympics for the air pollution control. That lessons can also be transferred to other countries like India or the other developing countries. They are facing increasingly serious air pollution levels, and our experience as scientists working with the government, and it have been very fruitful in the controlling policy and become an policy actions at the local and the national levels, could be also very useful for those countries too. So I think international collaboration could increase our knowledge about issues we are studying. We share the knowledge experience, and we can jointly to deal much more challenging issues together, and can get many challenges dealt with.
You can actually make a change on a global level, like with the Montreal Protocol, as we brought up before, is
right.
When you have different groups collaborating together, you can actually create an impact.
Yes.
Excellent. Well, we see Anne, so
that's
our time. That's our time.
Yeah.
Tong time.
Yeah.
But we really appreciate this chance to interview you and hear your story and learn more. I think it's very impactful, everything that you said.
Yeah. Thank you for both taking the time to do this, sit down and have this interview, but also the time that you spend volunteering to help AGU make be what it is.
It's my pleasure.
Very appreciate it.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Excellent. So I'm going to shut this off, and then I'm going to get a